Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and Jeff Chang is with us now. Maybe you know his award-winning book, Can't Stop, Won't Stop, A History of the Hip-Hop Generation. In his new book, Jeff Chang examines the role of artists in culturally desegregating America, though he worries that media images now look more desegregated than real life is for most Americans. Jeff Chang is director of the Stanford University Institute for Diversity in the Arts. The book, which includes fascinating and fun reproductions of advertisements and works of art over the last 50 years, is called Who We Be, The Colorization of America. Jeff Chang, thanks for coming on WNYC today.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
So the historical arc in this book is from 1963 to the present. So let's start in 63, the year of the I Have a Dream speech, March on Washington. You describe a group of artists here in New York anticipating the march, but unable to come up with anything that matched the discipline of the civil rights movement itself. Can you tell us some of that history to start? Who in the arts was involved in anticipating the March on Washington, and where did they get stuck?
Sure. This is Spiro we're talking about, a group of African-American artists, including Romare Bearden. I mean, a lot of the big names, Norman Lewis, a whole bunch of folks. And I think the point that I was trying to make there was that artists have a different process than folks who are working in organizing, activism, and politics. And the idea was to try to figure out a way to support the folks who are putting together the March on Washington by creating images that would help to uplift the race. And I think that, you know, folks would have debates, deep debates, about exactly how you did that. Did you do that from the point of view of representing your truth as an artist? Did you were you in service to the civil rights movement or to the other movements that were activated at that particular point? And sort of that play of questions proved to be something that was part of the process, but I think is also something that made them not as disciplined, as you said.
Well, what was the alternative? As do you make art that is specifically designed to uplift the race, in that case, the black race, or what?
Right. Or are you, by representing yourself and speaking to your truth
as an individual,
representing the race in the best way?
Now, the first artist whose images you feature in the book is the cartoonist Maury Turner and his comic strip We Pals, which debuted in 1965. Can you talk briefly about We Pals? It's kind of an integrated cartoon strip, right?
Yeah. Maury Turner was the first syndicated African-American cartoonist. And what was really interesting is he was inspired directly by Charles Schulz, the creator of Peanuts, to create a strip that was about kids, but a multiracial cast of kids trying to figure out literally how to get along. The really interesting thing about Maury, and I think about arts in general, is that when the civil rights movement is successful in bringing down or beginning to bring down the infrastructure of legal segregation, it still can't tell you how to live together, right? And so this is where the artists enter. And We Pals, which debuted in February of 1965, you know, before Watts, a couple of weeks before Malcolm X is assassinated, and before the Civil Rights Act the Voting Rights Act is finally passed, is a way of actually saying this is how we can choose to live together. And it's, you know, something that's light and punchline-y and allows people to see different ways of living.
That's great. You also have a Turner cartoon of what looks like a black GI with a Nazi armband on his uniform on a psychologist or a psychiatrist's couch. And the psychologist is also black, and he tells the GI, "Your case is destined to make psychiatric history." What was that about?
It was funny because, you know, Maury had this really light, humorous cartoon in which he was sort of inserting these kinds of images of desegregation into the funny pages. He colorized the funny pages, so to speak. But he also had these very edgy cartoons that he was doing in Black Digest, Negro World, and what later became Black Digest. And so the cartoon described, I chose that because it reminded me of the Dave Chappelle skit of the black Nazi, the blind black Nazi, right, Clayton Bigsby. And I was thinking, wow, Maury's doing this in like the 1960s, years before, you know, Chappelle is
right,
doing this.
Who was considered edgy at that time.
Mm-hmm, absolutely, and still is in some respects.
Yes, absolutely.
So here, you know, here again, our artists anticipating being sort of prophetic about the future, and also the role of race comedy in helping us to think about race in a different way.
My guest, Jeff Chang. His new book is called Who We Be, The Colorization of America. And chapter 4 of the book is subtitled The Invention of Multiculturalism. And it begins with your sentence, multiculturalism, what a waste of syllables. Was there a moment of invention of that word?
I think so. You know, before the multiculturalist avant-garde begins to arrive in the early 70s, in places like New York and Los Angeles, but particularly in the Bay Area, the dominant paradigm, so to speak, is that America is of one culture. You talk about one American culture, one way of being American.
Integration and melting pot.
Melting pot, right. So integration meant assimilation to a lot of artists of color, and it meant giving up your uniqueness, your own background, your own cultural you know, sort of strengths in your history. And what Ishmael Reed was proposing at the time, and he dropped it into a little article in the Berkeley Barb in 1975, was that we understand America as a multiculture. And that, at that time, it seems sort of non-argumentative now, right? Non-controversial
yeah,
now.
Right.
At that time, to talk about a culture being multi was paradoxical. It was a radical kind of move. It was a breakthrough.
And so threatening to white people
and
who
so
thought they were going to be eaten by this.
I was part of the first generation of college students to start experiencing the backlash against this. I was in the first freshman class at UC Berkeley that was predominantly non-white. That was more than 50% non-white.
Class you graduated what year?
I graduated in 1989.
Oh, uh-huh.
Yeah, so I entered in 1985. And part of this book was about unpacking the culture wars that break out during that particular time.
And in a minute, I want to talk about how we heard some of those culture wars expressed in the early years of the show, which started in 89,
mm-hmm.
and how I think it's really dissipated a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to go through a little more of the history first to bring us to that, because you have a section in the book later about how multiculturalism goes mainstream,
mm-hmm.
when
mm-hmm.
and how.
For me, you know, and I wrote about this in Can't Stop, Won't Stop, and I kind of really developed it a lot more in Who We Be. For me, it happens in the mid-90s, and particularly after the Los Angeles riots, when I think consumer companies, I almost have a picture in my head of a bunch of executives watching images of looters and saying, why aren't those people buying the stuff? Aren't we supposed to be bringing them into this sort of new vision of global capitalism? And so it's really interesting, because what you see is consumer companies moving very directly in the late 90s from serving what has been in the past primarily a white suburban middle-class base, thinking about how to serve the world, which is predominantly young and predominantly not white.
Is this the United Colors of Benetton and things like that?
I think so. I think that that's the Benetton moment. I think that that's the moment which begins in the 80s. And after the 90s, this is the moment of hip-hop, actually. Hip-hop becomes the perfect vehicle for companies to pivot from selling into white suburbia to selling to the urban world.
And listeners, I'm curious to hear your stories. You've heard enough of this conversation to probably be having some reactions right now. So whether you are white, black, Latino, Asian, other, or some combination thereof, give us a call and tell us how your relationship to the concept of multiculturalism has changed over the years. And no matter what age you are, it might have changed. If you're 25, it might be different than when you were 15. You know, if you're 75, it might be different than when this first broke out in the 80s or even the late 70s. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or go to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show, and leave a comment. One of your chapters that I think tells the story of sort of the height culture wars around this is something we talked about on this show back in 1993 when the famous Whitney Biennial at the Whitney Museum that was identity-based took place here in the city. And, you know, I remember we did at least one segment on the white backlash to the show, especially to the tags, and this is going to jog some of your memories, folks, that were given out to visitors that said, "I can't imagine wanting to be white."
Yeah, I can't imagine ever wanting to be white.
Uh-huh. How do you look back on the significance of that biennial?
Oh man, it was pivotal. You know, it was pivotal. I think that in some ways it was the culmination of a lot of these currents around multiculturalism. Again, at this particular point, what we have is a culture war in which one side is arguing that multiculturalism is going to lead to the end of American civilization. The chapter is actually – I have a chapter called It's the End of the World as We Know It, right?
In fact, I remember we had a guest – we had a Puerto Rican activist guest in, I guess, around the same time, 92, 93 – and I asked him this question that people kept raising in the media: isn't this going to lead to the Balkanization of America? I remember this is 1992. And he said, "I'd be more concerned about the Balkanization of the Balkans," as the Bosnia wars and genocides were breaking out.
Yeah.
Saying, "Hey, you know, we're still going to be all Americans here, but we're going to respect our identities."
It was interesting. I mean, you had that on the one hand, and you had, on the other hand, sort of, again, like, you know, your guest was mentioning at that time, sort of this vision of, well, look, there's all of this cultural difference here. If we looked at it that way and understand that the exchange is where all of the vitality comes from, all of the interesting things come out of, then we might be moving somewhere. And I think that that's something that's come back around, actually, in recent years. And that's what led to actually writing the book.
And I guess with 20 years of hindsight, the meaning of giving out those tags, "I can't imagine ever wanting to be white," was a consciousness-raising exercise to let mostly white patrons to the Whitney think about racial self-hate that minority cultures experience so much?
I think that was probably part of it. I mean, it was really interesting when I interviewed – Daniel Joseph Martinez was the artist who created these museum tags. And when I interviewed him about it, I said, you know, "Were you thinking about the debates that were happening around the Harlem Renaissance around black is beautiful, around, you know, this notion that you should be proud of who you are and where you come from?" And then folks on the other side, you know, George Schuyler, Langston Hughes saying that, "Black is beautiful." And on the other side, George Schuyler saying, "Hey, you know what? We're all Americans actually here. Let's not fool ourselves. Like, we're all in this together," type of thing.
Right.
And were you thinking about those debates? And he said, "No, actually I wasn't." But he had captured something of that, you know, of that internal double consciousness that, you know, people of color continue to experience every day.
Jeff Chang, author of Who We Be, The Colorization of America. And so picking up on that, thinking about it in the 25-year frame that we've been using in our anniversary series, the political heat around multiculturalism seems to have evaporated quite a bit. Mostly I don't hear the white backlash on the phones the way that I once did to the idea of what we call multiculturalism, of teaching history through different cultural perspectives, or that diverse people living in the real world would identify strongly with their particular heritage in addition to being American. I think people more broadly than ever before accept that as just normal and common sense. Does it look like that to you?
I think that multiculturalism has been successful in a lot of ways, and one is to reset the bounds of civility, right? So that that we have ways that we're able to discuss these types of things. But it's only been partial. You know, I think that what multiculturalism has taught us is what not to say in some ways, but it hasn't necessarily taught us what to say next. And so the thing that we need to get to is still to have this conversation about inequity and inequality. And so that's a lot of what
Absolutely.
The book
and
is about.
Still very difficult conversations.
Absolutely.
And maybe it's, you know, easy for me as a white person to sit here and say, "Oh, look at all the progress that white people have made." But I do definitely feel like I hear a difference, especially among white callers from in past years. And at the same time, I think ethnic nationalism, in any hardcore sense, has lost. And so to generalize or maybe overgeneralize, it seems to me that people, at least in New York, you know, by and large, want serious respect for their differences, but then also just want to live in an integrated America with a lot of common identity as well, not instead of, but as well, which I think was always the multicultural ideal.
Yeah. And I think that that's certainly well established, but we still can't have this discussion about inequity and inequality. And that's really real. You know, a lot of the polls revealed it after Ferguson. A lot of the polls last year as well, after the George Zimmerman verdict, revealed this sort of divide in even the way that we talk about it. So there's gaps in wealth. There's gaps in income. You know, folks of color are on the other side of that gap in wealth and income, in home ownership and educational achievement and attainment. And also they're on the other side of the gap in terms of the way that we think and talk about and what we tell our children about race as well.
And these conversations keep breaking out one by one by one around inequity, around injustice. Like, I think the national conversation about marijuana, regardless of Colorado and Washington State, legalizing recreational marijuana has really changed from kind of a baby boom, hippie, oh, should we bust people using marijuana conversation, to the criminal justice system and the amount of unnecessary contact that young people of color have with the criminal justice system, and how it affects their futures for having a little bit of pot in public while white people are smoking it in their middle-class homes and being left alone. That I think that's just an example of how the conversation is changing and needs to change so that we keep focusing on these inequity issues.
Absolutely. And so that's the paradox that we're in, right? On the one hand, we have cultural desegregation. We have the ABC fall lineup, you know, in which, you know, women of color and families of color are centered. And then on the other hand, we have this halting conversation. We're able to move forward, as you mentioned, on certain kinds of issues. But we also have these sort of moments where there are explosions, where inequity and inequality get put into our right in front of us. And we're not able to go deep with that kind of thing. We've also figured out a ritual as well. So somebody says something crazy, some celebrity says something really insane, and we've figured out sort of this ritual of shunting them off within 36 hours of the news cycle.
Who are you thinking about?
Don Sterling, right? Or Mel Gibson, or Michael Richards, or Don Imus, right? And within 36 hours, we've kind of buried it. And we haven't come back to it. And Charles Blow, I think, wrote this amazing editorial where he said,
New York Times columnist Charles Blow,
where he said, why do we only have the conversation when we have these horrible incidents that crop up? This should be something that we should all be pushing towards.
Because the real conversation is deeper than that, and it's subtler than that.
It's subtler than that.
But it's more ongoing than that.
And the whole sort of thing is, you know, people talk about 2042, right? This sort of magical moment where it all comes together, or this horrible moment where
2042 is the census people say that's when there will be no ethnic majority in the United States. White people will be under 50%, so there will be no majority by white, black, Latino, Asian.
And the main question I think that we have to ask is, if we're all minorities then, or if we're minorities now already in New York and San Francisco and Los Angeles and California, how do we form a new majority?
And I like to think that New York is emerging as a bit of a model for that. Not that there aren't deep problems. I mean, look at public education. We are intensely segregated in terms of housing in this city. But by the same token, the city is finding its way, and there's a lot of tolerance in New York City, and it's not this, you know, culturally all against all nightmare that those who feared multiculturalism in the earlier days thought we'd come to.
I think that's absolutely true. And I think that at the same time, we see, you know, rising tides of Islamophobia, right? And we see rising tides of sort of on the campuses, for instance, racial incidents. It's been a really interesting thing for me to be at Stanford University and see over the last couple of years students beginning to organize around racial incidents that are happening on the campuses, because I'm like, wow, this is what I was going through 25 years ago why is it still happening? And so in some ways, it's a sad thing for me, you know, a sad example of the ways in which the way that we see race has not changed.
Jeff Chang from Stanford University, author of Who We Be, The Colorization of America, and Edson in Manhattan. You're on WNYC with Jeff Chang. Hi, Edson.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you, sir.
I'm from Brazil, and I went to school in the middle 80s, college over there. And even though Brazil is well-known around the world as a racial democracy, just to give a perspective, Brazil population is like 200 million, and half of the Brazilian population is Afro-descendant or black. However, when I went to school, to college, we never studied Afro-Brazilian history. I only studied European or American whites. So, you know, learning about multiculturalism, I learned over here when I came to America, to New York in the 90s. So I learned about Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, Harlem Renaissance, and other authors. So it was really opening. You know, Brazilians like to talk about racial democracy. We are a diverse country. But when it comes to study, it's still European studies.
Do you think, Edson, that there's a similar conversation going on in Brazil? I think there is, but that's just from sitting here in New York and reading some articles. In Brazil, to what we're having here on this show and what's taking place in America today about these issues?
Yes, I think, you know, one of the good things about the internet, you know, in all this communication, that people in Brazil, you know, Afro-descendant and blacks, they know what's going on in America, and they can relate it. They can look and say, hey, listen, look what's happening over there. And population in America, Afro-Americans, they are like 13%, and over here we are 50%.
Yes.
So blacks in Brazil, they are demanding now, they want to know more about Afro-Brazilian history.
Fascinating. Edson, I really appreciate you chiming in. So the United States is not the only country struggling with this kind of conversation. And from the Brazilian cross-cultural experience, I think we're going to get a Canadian one now from Sudha in Fort Greene. You're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah. Judging by the comment from your guest that graduated in 1989, we're roughly the same age, except I'm from Canada, and the difference is I grew up under official multiculturalism. When we moved to Canada in 1969-70, it became a government policy. And so it was very interesting to see at that time in Canada how new immigrants were coming from all over the world, particularly from South Asia, Caribbean, and a policy sort of anticipated a lived reality that ultimately occurred. I think that had both beneficial consequences as well as some unintended consequences. I remember very clearly when that term people of color started being used on campuses across Canada, and I felt very, I don't know, for, at that time I felt very uncomfortable having my identity, which is a very complex thing, being defined by a color, and at least that was my position now. Now I'm much more comfortable with it.
What's your own background, roughly?
Oh, I'm from South Asia. I'm from India, from South India, in fact.
Uh-huh.
And I was born in India and moved to Toronto as a young boy. And we used to come to the States a lot to visit. And we were always taught in school that, well, America's a melting pot, and we have a cultural mosaic.
Mm.
And when I came to the U.S., I'm like, well, this is not really a melting pot. I would visit my cousins in Long Island and in Queens, and we'd go to Indian temples, and we'd have Indian food, and we'd hang out. And they would have friends from different races. And so I'm like, it's really not that different. But then the sort of larger media argument, it was this huge issue here I could never quite understand. And I was wondering if your guest could shed some light on that.
Wow, this is an amazing conversation. I grew up in Honolulu, Hawaii. So I grew up actually in a culture that was already a place that was already, you know, quote unquote majority minority, and so I think that drives a lot of what I'm interested in. I also grew up in a family, you know, people talk about changing demographics. I can talk about changing demographics. I grew up in a family where folks had, you know, intermarried for many generations, And so that provided to me kind of a different kind of model as well. So I can really relate actually to hearing stories about Canada and Brazil here. People often talk about Brazil being a model. People also talk about Canada being a model. I think the U.S. actually has a lot to learn from the histories of multiculturalism in Brazil and in Canada. And, you know, 1973 is the year that there was an official ministry set up in Canada for multiculturalism. That's also the year that Bob Marley and Bruce Lee come out and begin to change our ideas of what identity is globally. And so, you know, these are things that we actually don't have conversations about. When we have conversations about race in the U.S., it's very much focused on the U.S., and it's very much coming from a point of view of sort of an innocence, a sort of lack of context and a lack of history. So I'm thrilled that we're being able to talk about these different types of experiences.
What challenges or opportunities do you think it presented you, coming from your Asian American background, to become the scholar of hip-hop that you have and, you know, that first hit book that you had, which was about hip-hop?
That's a really interesting question. I mean, I came to hip-hop from this post-multicultural kind of point of view where, you know, in hip-hop, in sort of the aesthetics of hip-hop, there's sort of a meritocracy. You step into the cipher and you offer what you got, and if it's good, then you get recognized for it. If it's not good, then you go home and work on it and come back. And so there's, you know, there's an assumption, I guess, that it's not open to, non-African-American folks. But that's never been true. Hip-hop was always an Afro-diasporic thing, and it was always something that was open to folks who wanted to embrace it and really wanted to come to it. It's built on a history of Afro-diasporic cultures and a history of oppression of people of African descent. But it's not the type of thing that is exclusive in that kind of a way. So I'm like millions of other folks who grew up on hip-hop. I'm a kid that came up during a time when hip-hop was offering us an alternative to what we saw on television. Even in Hawaii growing up, this predominantly sort of white suburban ideal that we had to assimilate to.
Basil in Williamsburg, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi. Let me just turn down my radio. I'm originally from D.C., African American of technically mixed origin, but being from the South, essentially, we've always called ourselves black. And I have a very ambivalent relationship to the idea of multiculturalism because being a monolithic body has served African Americans so well, calling themselves black. I do agree that the populations in Brazil and in South Africa, if you look at them, they weren't able to overcome what we've overcome because they were stratified into so many different
categories.
Labels.
Yeah.
And categories and being multi and actually being multicultural and being racial. Whereas here, no matter how mixed you were black, and that allowed us to be one monolithic body, and there was a lot of strength in that. So I'm always ambivalent about it, but I do embrace the idea that it allows me to bridge into other cultures and to be one with a larger group of people with a common purpose. But I did want to just see what your guests had to say about that.
Yeah, I think that thank you for that. I think that there ought to be some sort of ambivalence because in some ways the multiculturalism that we have now has been kind of defanged. It's something that's been thoroughly commodified. It's a kind of thing where identity is really the currency now of global capitalism. We're talking about, you were talking about this earlier with Ad Age, you know,
right.
The collecting of data and the selling back to you of your identity. What all of that neglects are the structures and the institutions that have been put in place that emphasize and reinforce in every generation anti-black racism. And we have to be real about that. And I think that that's part of the conversation that we don't have when we go to that sort of happy multicultural place. Is not to look at the nuts and bolts of resegregation and why that's happening.
Let me get one more in here. Paul in Red Bank. You're on WNYC. Hi, Paul.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call. I was born in 1985 when your speaker was first going to college, and I grew up in suburban New Jersey. And one thing that I always noticed when I was a kid was that if you were a white suburban kid who was really interested in, you know, non-white cultures, like when I was a kid, I was really fascinated by Japanese and Indian cultures, it was considered strange. Mm. You know, like other people would say, why do you like that? Like, why are you interested in something that isn't your ethnic culture? But now, it being, you know, I'm 29 now, I look at kids and I see that it's more normal for kids to be fascinated and to kind of adopt aspects of other cultures into themselves. So I feel like progress over the course of the 29 years that I've been alive has happened, and that makes me happy. And one other thing, just because of what I heard one of your other callers say about interracial relationships, for 3 years, I dated a Indian girl. Her family was from Kerala. They were Malayali.
Mm-hmm.
And most of my friends didn't really think much of it. I did have a couple, though, who said, how can you date someone who isn't white? And so I guess it's kind of two sides of the same coin, that while I've seen some things improve very much with my generation, at the same time I see other things that haven't really changed at all. So while I'm very heartened by the changes, I know that we're not there yet, really, in multiculturalism, where it's not an issue. I almost kind of think it'll be nice with multiculturalism when it's not really a question anymore. It's just something that's accepted as normal and not asked about, like the question why.
Hmm. So well put, and so reflective of the theme of the book, I think.
Yeah, thank you for that story. It really is. We're really in a really interesting kind of paradoxical place, and I think that again, it returns down to this thing of we have made progress over the last five decades, but on the other hand, we're in a situation in which, we haven't been able to address these longstanding questions of racial justice. And I think that the main thing for me is that I'm interested in having the conversation. I'm interested in not being colorblind. I'm interested in us not being color mute. I'm interested in us having these kinds of conversations that emphasize exchange. And it goes back to what the caller was talking about in terms of even being able to understand folks through the kinds of stuff that they're doing, creating, and again, sort of the role that artists, the central role that artists play in helping us to imagine different kinds of futures.
We're getting so many great calls and stories. This is like one of the best conversations we've had on the show all year, I think. Can you stay till the end of the hour?
I'd
about
be happy
another
to.
15 minutes?
I'd be thrilled.
We're
going
to continue with Jeff Chang, author of Who We Be, The Colorization of America. Keep calling, whether you're white, black, Latino, Asian, other, or any combination thereof, younger, older, in between, as we talk about our changing relationship with multiculturalism in the arts and in real life. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. WNYC with Stanford University Professor Jeff Chang. You may know him from his American Book Award winning previous book, Can't Stop, Won't Stop, about hip hop. His new one is called Who We Be, The Colorization of America. And this is a great book to look at in addition to read the history in, about 300 pages. And it's got all kinds of images of advertising, of journalism, of fine arts, reflecting on how we see culture from different racial and ethnic perspectives in this country, and mainstream versus niche and all of that over the last 50 years. So Who We Be, The Colorization of America. I want to ask what you think the future of white identity is going to be in this country if we're heading toward a 2042 world where there is no majority, if the threat to people of color of assimilation in the background was that their identities were going to melt away into one general American thing, which is really white, And if the white position on that in the past was blindness, if you're the majority, you can't necessarily see that you're a particular thing. You just think you're the general thing.
Mm-hmm.
If there's no general thing, are there going to be, you know, white student unions at colleges?
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
could they be something other than Aryan nationalism and supremacy?
That's such a good question. And I think that it's really rich, and I don't really know fully the answers to that. A good friend, but I'll nonetheless take a stab at it, right? so I think
that's why we pay you the big bucks.
Right.
All guests appear for free, by the way.
So, you know, in 2009, my good friend Hua Su wrote this article for The Atlantic called The End of Whiteness, and it was really profound for me. It was really eye-opening in so many different kinds of ways. It made me think that what I was thinking about in terms of developing the ideas for this book was not crazy at all. And so the threads that he kind of began there, I've kind of followed through on in some respects. One of the things that's really interesting to me is immediately after the article comes out, you begin to see the renewal of the culture wars by folks who are scared of multiculturalism. And so these are folks who are preying on fears of a changing country. And we can include Glenn Beck in there. We can include Sarah Palin in there. We can include Andrew Breitbart in there. And we can include a whole host of other folks who were not necessarily themselves making outrageous accusations like Obama being a socialist or
Kenya.
Being born in Kenya, right? But certainly fueling that kind of fire. In 2010, Time Magazine did a top 10 ideas of the year. One of them, number 7, with a bullet, was white anxiety crisis. And so, you know, for me, what that illustrates is our inability to be able to have these kinds of conversations at a nuanced kind of level like we're having today allows the extremists to come in and prey upon fears of people. At the same time that all of this is going on, there's a lot of amazing activity happening amongst young whites talking about how do we have a conversation about privilege, what privilege means, and at the same time talking about, you know, what does it look like for me to be able to raise my kids down the line in a society that's changed. And I think that those are ongoing. I don't know if we're going to be having white student unions in 25 years that are different from the white citizens' councils of the past. It may be a natural outgrowth of what happens, but the main point, I think, is for us to be able to get to a place where everybody can feel that they are able to come up in a society in which they're able to express themselves and their backgrounds and reach their full potential opportunity-wise. And I think that that's the thrust of what we're heading towards.
And so the very beginning of an era of these new conversations.
Mm-hmm.
Parta in Livingston, you're on WNYC. Hello, Parta.
Good morning, Brian. Good morning, Professor Chang. This is my third call into your show.
Thank you.
The first one was about Churchill, and the second one was when a judge proclaimed homosexuality banned in India.
Uh-huh. Thank you for your participation. Go ahead.
I did use a movie, Rabindranath Tagore, the poet of Italy.
Sorry, so you were breaking up. Say that again.
I had produced a documentary. I had directed and partially produced, co-produced a documentary called Rabindranath Tagore, the poet of eternity.
Mm.
And Rabindranath Tagore in 1920s and 30s gave his vision of one world. He visited about 34 countries in the world, including United States 5 times, met Einstein 4 times, and he visited China, Japan, Canada, and many other countries. He gave his vision of in India, a 5,000 years old culture, speak about 21 different tongues at home.
And so, and because we have such a bad phone line, I'm going to try to focus this to a point, which is Yes, I get it. The poet of eternity who wrote in India and talked about the many different cultures coming together as one, at least in his ideal world, I guess. How does it relate to America today? Parta. I guess we lost him entirely. We'll do it again, Parta. Call me back another day. How about Ankur on Long Island? You're on WNYC. Hello.
Thanks for taking my call. So I just wanted to add to the conversation. I'm a young professional. I'm in my mid-30s. I grew up in New York City listening to hip-hop in the 90s. And, you know, and during that time, the socioeconomic, association with hip-hop, you know, was different. And now, growing, you know, as a physician, my friends are physicians, and we listen to hip-hop and celebrate hip-hop music, and that socioeconomic status is not associated with us, but, you know, that art is still there. And I just wanted to add, you know, I think that changed, and I'm always fascinated by who listens to hip-hop now growing up in the 90s, and it's, you know, it's across all boards, not just that one socioeconomic class that was coming out for the music back in the 90s.
Jeff?
Yeah, it's changed, right? It's changed quite a bit. The market for hip-hop has changed quite a bit. It's become mainstream in a lot of respects. In the 90s, in some ways, it was still an insurgent movement and insurgent culture. Sort of a meeting place for a lot of folks from different kinds of backgrounds. And certainly Afrika Bambaataa, the founder of Universal Zulu Nation, was sort of the visionary within hip-hop who demonstrated through just even the music that he played, coming from all these different types of musical genres, from a bunch of different types of places, from German music to Nigerian music to on and on and on, illustrating kind of the ways that folks could come together so that polyrhythm becomes a model for polyculturalism, this polycultural kind of practice.
We have a minute left. Can you give me a 30-second soundbite on the impact of Obama, you know, which started his presidency, started with talk about a post-racial era. You deconstruct the iconic Shepard Fairey Obama Hope poster in the book, and you show it, and with, you know, Obama's face half in red and half in a kind of yellowy beige.
Mm-hmm.
Where are we 6 years into Obama?
We're sort of at this, again, paradoxical kind of point, right? On the one hand, we have a black president. We are celebratory of multiculturalism and diversity. And on the other hand, we have these rising indices of resegregation happening. And that's a strange and kind of unusual thing. But that's sort of what the book is about, that contradiction.
And the book is called Who We Be, The Colorization of America, as Afrika Bambaataa will take us out. The author Jeff Chang at Stanford University and in our studio. Thank you so much. This has been really awesome.
Thank you so much, Brian.